This is Matthew Putman, and you're listening to Utility Function. If you've read my previous blog posts or think pieces, you're probably aware of my concerns about our current approach to globalization. We've adopted a worldview that is overly transactional and commodified, which makes the idea of globalized society a charged topic. I believe firmly in directing the power of new technologies towards social good, and I'm interested in exploring their potential for creating a more harmonious form of globalization. To revisit these ideas, I decided to give my dear friend and collaborator Anwar Al-Mahmid a call. Anwar has a background in finance and is a crypto entrepreneur. She and I started working together in 2020 after we met at an event and discovered a mutual interest in nanotechnology. As a Middle Eastern thought leader on blockchain, I wanted to hear her thoughts on our emerging paradigm of decentralized technologies. We got into a deeper conversation on the meaning of coincidences, Anwar's gratitude for her Kuwaiti community, and the role of nanofactories in creating a globalized future. Using the principles of nanotech, we envision a world where nations can take ownership of local resources while collaborating with one another through idea exchange and mutual support. So we talk all the time, and I want to get into so much of, you know, your background and, you know, what inspired you, who your mentors were, all of those things. But one thing that has inspired me about you is how much you read and how that influences the work you do. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'm a single child, right? Single parent. And so I had a lot of time on my hands. I grew up in London. And so I didn't even grow up in the first half of my childhood around my cousins and extended family. So it was just me and my mom. And so I had so much time to read and so much time alone. So I used to read a lot and I loved it. And I used to read novels and stuff. And so as I grew up, I you know, this is just way more interesting to me than watching a movie sometimes than going out. I mean, it's a bit isolating at times, but because like every book you read, no matter what I'm reading about, is just new knowledge that I can then relate to everything else I've read. And so it's very exciting to me because it's like opening up and expanding my universe every time I read something. So actually meeting you kind of encouraged me to read certain types of books that maybe I was intimidated to read in the past or just didn't bother to read because I didn't think it relevant or I thought it maybe too technical for me to read. But because you gave me a lot of confidence, I started reading all these other books. And so once I started, I realized, oh, wow, all you need to do is really take that step. Start reading it, and then you can actually pretty much, you know, there's nothing that you can't understand if you read the right books.
Well, yeah. I mean, one thing you're doing right now is investing in some really, you know, deep tech companies. So some things that are technologically very challenging in a way. How's that been?
It started with blockchain for me, and blockchain is actually my first. It's what sparked my interest in technology, because before that, I didn't really bother learning about how technology worked. I'd enjoy the technology itself, but I wouldn't really look into it or understand the under the hood exactly what's happening. And so with blockchain, because it was something completely new and I had to just like re-educate myself, I had to look under the hood. I had to start understanding how the internet works, how the phone works, how all these wireless technologies work, all of that stuff, because I wanted to understand really everything going on related to blockchain. What are the risks? What can happen? Am I doing the right thing by investing in this and kind of dedicating my life to it? Not my life, my life at the time to it. And so for me, it forced me to start learning these technologies. And then when you start investing in these different companies, obviously for me, Nanotronics, a newer company, was a turning point because I got to, you know, learn from you, and you kind of pushed me into deeper and deeper technologies. Again, same as reading, just all these other things that I was intimidated by, but I was reading about, but never thought I would ever invest in or understand to the point where I can invest in it, like quantum computing and biotech and all these other stuff that we're looking at together.
Yeah, it's amazing getting to work with you on these things. And you know, you push me in many different directions too, and inspire me all the time. I want to go back a little and talk about this international childhood. Your mother is one of the most fascinating, coolest people I know. So how did your mother have an influence on you to get here?
Oh, my mom is like, I don't even know if influence is the word. I kind of feel like sometimes I didn't have a choice in becoming who I am today. I think she kind of made me completely. Every little part of me. Every time I think I'm rebelling against something she taught me and thought I, you know, came up with this by myself as I grew up, I realize, oh, she actually did that. This is all her influence and her kind of, I mean, we have now the same taste. Excuse me. We have the same taste in everything. And so it's kind of weird. As I grow older and older, I'm just like, we're just converging, me and her as a person. She inspired me a lot. I watched her, you know, she was a cardiologist in London. You know, this young Arab woman with a child in London, kind of just trying to prove herself through and just, you know, really commit to her job day and night, but yet she was so present in my life. I still today don't understand. I literally asked her this maybe a month ago. I was like, how did you, I don't understand how you were so present yet you were, you know, working 24 hours a day in the hospital. I don't
understand. And
then, you know, and so basically she took me with her everywhere. I lived in the hospital for a while. Like I was there with her as a baby. I remember like I'd stay in her office and play solitaire on this old Macintosh, not Macintosh, on this old like Windows computer. And so she, you know, she inspired me in many different ways. I saw her go through a lot of struggles, but I also saw her, she loves life. So she's into the arts, she's into beauty, she's into socializing, she's into everything you can imagine, history, politics, all of it. And so I kind of was in like this whirlwind of an experience as a child, just with her. I just tagged along with her. I was her accessory. And so for me, that was amazing and obviously influenced everything in my life. I really don't know which part of me is me as opposed to, you know, what my mom embedded in me.
Actually. Well, no, that's fascinating. I mean, your mother is amazing, but you seem certainly have gone in a different direction, been your own person. That's for sure.
Yeah, that was intentional. I tried.
Yeah, you're not a doctor, but you could be. All that you, I'm sure you could have learned a lot from. I can't imagine being around sick people as a child. Was that difficult?
So I no, not really. Actually, it's interesting. I never thought of this one, but no, because she's so professional. You know, my mom is actually super super emotional, and I asked her that too. I'm like, how does that work? You're a doctor. I don't understand how you're so emotional and yet you're a cardiologist that's basically faces death every day. And so she obviously explains to me the way she does it is she completely disconnects. She's able to just be a completely different person when she's in that operation room or whatever. And then when she goes home, she'll just like, you know, she'll have all the emotions you can imagine, the rainbow of emotions. And so for me, no, it wasn't hard because it was always very formal, very professional when we were in the workplace with her. So I didn't feel that. And she wasn't cold, you know, as a human being because of it. She was actually extremely emotional, extremely love, like showering me with love, sometimes just suffocating me with love. So I don't, you know, I didn't feel any of that.
Yeah. You know, one thing that you do that everybody notices is that you're extremely close, compassionate, and helping with your founders of the companies you're involved with. Yet it's also extremely professional, and we all get a lot from that. Can you talk a little bit about how you I guess choose your founders or choose, you know, what to be involved with?
Yeah. So you know, as I said, I'm really interested in deep tech because to me, it's that thing. I think I learned over time. And apparently I said this to my cousin once, she told me, I don't remember saying it, but she said I said that if I'm not scared of something, I'm not interested in doing it. And so for me, if it's, you know, the more kind of complicated it is, the more technical it is, and yet the more transformative it can be as a technology, that excites me. That excites me a lot. And so the founders working on these kinds of companies that not only build these companies, but are also able to explain it to someone like me in layman terms, or at least slowly guide me into it. Like yourself, of course, being maybe the main one in my life, but also all these other founders that I speak to. If they're able to teach me not just the technology, not just the technicalities of it, which I can Google, but also the application and their experience with it, which gives me a much richer kind of understanding of it. And so for me, this is just an incredible educational experience. And because of that, I get to admire these founders rather than, you know, think of them as just portfolio companies. I really truly admire these people. And so for me, it's a partnership in their journey.
Yeah.
And I know, and I'm conscious of it being their journey, and I'm just being a part of it.
Yeah. I mean, you were really deep in blockchain and specifically in crypto since what, 2017?
Yeah. So I found out about it in late 2016. 2017 is when I just quit and started investing.
I mean, that was before, you know, the sort of 2020, you know, run on everybody being involved, you know,
yeah.
You know, it was one of those things that everywhere you went, people were getting involved. You tell me about your journey a little bit. You started the East Chain company, is that right?
Yeah. So it started kind of just randomly. I had already quit my job, and it was a summer, and I was wondering what I wanted to do. I knew I really liked entrepreneurs because I had, you know, I have a lot of friends that are entrepreneurs, and I supported them from a very young age, and so I knew I liked that, and so I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. And so as I read up more and more and more about blockchain, I was like, wow, I you know, and I today don't believe at all in coincidence. So it felt to me like the right things happening at the right time for me, which is I had no idea what I wanted to do, but I was researching blockchain so much to the point where I was like, literally nothing else matters when I started understanding. I'm like, nothing else matters but this for me right now, because this is completely different. I have to erase all my knowledge. I have to just like relearn everything I can imagine, and all these lessons that I took from college and my few years of experience at the KIA and the stock exchange. And so for me, that was exciting, because what it meant was now I'm quitting my job. I'm starting from zero, but so is everyone else in this industry. Even though like there's people who are in it like 7-8 years ahead of me, it was still nothing, right? So at the time, it's still, we're all starting from scratch. And so for me, it felt like it was a perfect fit just to get into that.
Yeah. You don't believe in coincidence.
No.
That must be really informative in life when you everything you notice could be something of value, you know?
Yeah.
Is it an intense way to live?
No, it's so exciting. It's actually more so that I keep missing all the missing,
yeah,
all the messages or you know, not messages, but like all the things that I can use to help me do whatever I want to do, or help me in my path or my current path. And so, no, it's a much nicer way to live, because it means whatever is happening for you. And so you don't resist it. You don't fear it. You don't hate it. And you suddenly just are so accepting and grateful for everything happening, because, you know, it's not a coincidence. It's for you. It's part of your journey. It's part of your experience. And when I look at it that way, I actually extract more value from all these random things that happen around us. Otherwise, it's noise, right? If you don't think of it like that, then it's just noise. And it's like, why do I have so much noise in my life? But if I think of it as, no, this is all a part of it. If I look at the streets and I see these signs and this sign makes me think of something, then perfect. That was meant to do that for me. Or at least it was placed there so that I can use it if I need to. I don't know. It's just like, if life is a simulation, and if
is that right?
I don't know. No, I don't know. If life is a simulation, if all of this is not real, if it's just a test, if it's whatever it is, then I'd like to kind of capture as much of these messages as possible, or as much of the not messages. What's the word? Like the say it with me. Like triggers, or you know, just like just taking in all that scene. The scene that surrounds you, right?
Yeah, it feels like it really does influence you, because you sort of run and capture an opportunity, and you know, in ways that other people would miss. I do think that you find that.
Well, it makes the present moment exciting too, right, Matthew? Because then then it's exciting. Then you're just looking and observing and like, oh, what does this mean? What can this do? How can I use this? Oh, that's interesting. So you just like start really relishing the moment. And so for me, it's a nicer way to live.
Yeah. Now you tell me that is, you know, I'll be looking forward to something or talking about something in the future. You're like, why aren't you Why aren't you looking now at what's going on? It's really true. And I think about that even when I met you, you know, it's a good thing that we noticed, you know, there was a lot of noise. And somehow we still got to be close and now we're working much together.
Matthew, I met you because you were wearing a fedora. That's literally why. That's literally why, because I was like, oh, he looks like he's a musician or something. And then you started talking to me that you're a jazz musician. I didn't even know anything about nanotronics, which I'm now obsessed about. But at the time, you didn't even mention it. You were so humble. You're like, oh, I have an AI company. And you just like pushed it off to the side and started talking about your music. And so for me, had I ignored that, like that's why I don't believe in coincidence. I met you because, you know, you looked like the suave, really cool guy in New York. And so I was interested and curious in this event of eclectic people. I was interested and curious about what you did. And you spoke to me about jazz, nothing to do with anything we are now working on together. And so it's that kind of stuff that I don't think is a coincidence. I think it's there for you. You know, these are things in your environment that you're meant to pick at, that you're meant to play with and test and see.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. God, I'm glad I wore that hat. I had no idea I would do that.
Well, it was all of it, not just the hat. You had this, like, your energy was amazing.
Oh, man. So where are things today, do you think, with blockchain? How do you think things are moving along, crypto specifically?
Yeah, so... I think it's moving along well, as it should be. I think you know, the chaos that you saw in the recent couple of months that passed is necessary. You know, I think the blockchain industry is still incredibly immature, like incredibly immature when compared to other industries in finance, and so has a lot of room to grow. You need to weed out all of this, you know. You know, there's just very little risk management happening. And even when you see some risk management, if you compare it to what you see in Wall Street, it's not the same. So there's just a lot of room to grow. There's a lot of people that need to be educated outside of the industry, but also within the industry, they need to be educated. Because a lot of them, like, just, you know, these people came in at very, very young, invested and hit a jackpot. And now these are the ones building some of these companies, right? And so there's so much room to grow and so many egos to kind of maintain within the industry still. But it's amazing because blockchain is just going to open up everything for us, open up all these different types of systems that we can interact in. And I think it's necessary for us moving forward one way or another. So I'm excited for it as much as I was. I'm just now, now to me, it's not new. Now I think people understand it. People are picking it up and coming into it. And it's hit that point where I don't see it going anywhere but up from here, right? I'm not talking about price, but adoption and growth and kind of just like its impact on us. But now I think it's just going to be a nice and steady growth continuously. We might still see some crazy volatility in the prices, which will also create some hype cycles. But still, I think the technology itself is developing nicely. And now it's kind of, you know, I'm not worried about it as I was maybe in 2017. I wasn't worried about it, but we didn't know what was going to happen. We didn't know if governments were going to clap down on it or just stop it. So now I'm comfortable with it. And now there's other things that excite me as much as this did in 2017.
Yeah. Yeah. Once things get stable and you've worked on it, then you can move on to other things that are volatile.
Yeah. Yeah. Or at least other things that, you know, no one knows nothing about. Cause to me, it's the exciting thing is the you know, just gaining knowledge on it. So, once enough people know it, then I trust that this global community is going to build it great. And I'll be a part of it in whichever way I think, you know, I make sense and continuously. But now that's not my that's not what I wake up for every morning anymore. I want to wake up for the next thing.
Yeah. You know, you kind of come from, I don't know if it's conservative, but you worked at the KIA, which is the oldest, I think, sovereign wealth fund and one of the largest. And, you know, I don't know how conservative it is or not conservative, but I think of it as certainly they have an investment thesis. They work with you know, they know what their allocations are. It's not, it's sort of the opposite of jumping into something brand new as far as a, you know, thesis for investment. Can you talk a little bit about your time there, though? Because it seems to still have had an influence on you.
Yeah, well, yeah, KIA is the first sovereign wealth fund in the world. I mean, it's insane exposure, Matthew. I joined the KIA when I was 21, I think. And so at 21, you're sitting across the table from Ken Griffin, Bill Ackman, John Paulson, like everyone you can imagine, because I was at the hedge fund department. So, and on a daily basis, right? And you're a part of the team that makes a decision to invest in these guys or not, which is crazy. But it's an incredible experience, incredible exposure. But as you said, obviously, and they should be conservative. I mean, it works for them. The conservative, investing strategy works for them. They are long-term players, right? Yeah, they're very, very long-term. They come in with very big check sizes. This is for the future of the country's wealth, right? It's to maintain it more so than to make it, right? And so it makes sense how they do things. But yeah, that's a part of my frustration is I like exciting things. I like trying new things, which is very hard in a large institution like the KIA, which has over 450, maybe 500 people now. So it's there's so many levels you have to go through to approve an investment, obviously, because also the check sizes are very large. And so you don't get to do the types of deals I'm doing now at all. You don't even look at them. And so for me, while that's great, again, that's what I think the world can take care of, not me. I prefer to look at things that are new. I prefer to look at things that are pushing the boundaries. I prefer to see if we can do things completely differently. It's just my character, I think.
Yeah. How much do you, we talked about you growing up internationally. You know, you were in London and you went to university in California. But You seem very attached still to improvements in the region or sustainability in the region. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, So a lot of us in Kuwait and the region in general are very exposed to Western education, Western culture, and so all of us kind of, whether we grew up abroad or not, you get that influence just being here, but. But the thing is, you also like what you see, especially from my experience, was the support I received from this country and this region, from my family and my friends, just the way of life that's a bit easy and simple, which I was able to compare when I lived outside of Kuwait. It's a bit more wild. There's just so much more bills to pay. There's so much to, much more to balance, and which is amazing and really good for building character, of course. But for me, I don't know. I'm attached to this. I like the Arab culture. I feel like it's a part of me. I mean, I grew up within it, and it gives me a warm feeling when I think of it. I'd assume in America when you have Thanksgiving or Christmas, you feel this feeling of warmth. I feel that always when I think of the way things work here and the culture and the people and the music and all of that. And coming from Kuwait, Kuwait is was the only democracy within the GCC, is still actually. And it's a constitutional monarchy. So we have a parliament and we have a royal family. And so we were always more outspoken. We were always a bit, ahead of the region in certain respects, not so much anymore. But for me, I just have, I feel patriotic. My mom, again, has a lot of influence on me. And so my mom fought in the Gulf War. My mom is incredibly patriotic. And so she instilled a lot of that in me. And so because I grew up with these incredible people, I traveled and lived outside and I met amazing people. And they're some of the closest people in my life, including yourself and so many people I met in the US and elsewhere. But then I also know that there's no one like the people I know and have met back home. And so for me, it's important that my work or what I contribute to the world gets to them in one way or another, right? Benefits them in one way or another, because I feel they've done so much for me. And so for me, it's kind of just reciprocating all that value that I received from them. If there's something I can do in return, I'd want to do that. And so it's important for me. I also know, like, what they're made of and what potential there is that I feel is we are not reaching because of many different things in the environment here. And so I do want to help contribute to possibly be able to allow the people here that I know so well reach that potential.
Do you ever think about this, you know, post-oil future or a future where Kuwait is not completely tied to oil?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think about it a lot. I mean, this is something we all think about now.
First of all, are they? I mean, is that a misconception? Or it really is an oil-rich country, is that right?
Oh, yeah. It's still over 90% reliant on oil, Kuwait specifically. Yeah. I know, you know, other neighbors in the region are starting to diversify. And obviously, everyone has to think of that. Yeah, I think of that a lot. And because, you know, oil really gave us all the privilege that we experienced in the last two generations, I'd say. So, yeah, I think about it a lot. I do think we still have a lot of things that we can diversify into. We haven't yet. I think we can still play the energy game in a different form. And so, yeah, I think of it a lot. And that's kind of why these technologies that I invest in are exciting to me, because I don't think, you know, it makes sense for us to try to keep up with the rest of the world. I think it's time we just like leapfrog into something new. And because of the wealth that oil brought us, and because of the institutions like the KIA, we can take these risks on a small scale. It won't affect us. It'll barely, you know, we'll barely feel it in terms of our budget. But it will make a big difference, and it'll help us diversify, and it'll help breed the talent that's required for new industries in the future. And so, yeah, I think about that a lot. That's everything that I think about for my country.
Yeah, you know, I do too. I've never even been to Kuwait, and yet I keep pushing for us to do, the two of us to build a factory together in Kuwait that does something different. Not because I have any problem with the idea of being an oil-rich nation, but because it's exciting to think that you can make a big impact with something that is fairly small. And you know, I keep pushing for that.
Exactly. And that's what's amazing about you, Matthew, is like, not a lot of people think like that. You know, someone like you would rather think about profitability, would rather think about, I'll just set it in the, you know, in a place that I know and understand. But the fact that you care to set these factories up in places that might need it, might truly benefit from it, might literally transform everything about their economy, that's exciting to me, and that's why I love working with you, is because there's not many people like that, and this is our chance. This is a chance for a country like Kuwait to take that and really make something out of it.
Yeah, I really am excited about that. And yeah, it's an interesting way to pick a location.
Yeah, I mean, people ask me why Kuwait, and I'm like, well, you know, I'm from here. That's why. There's absolutely no other reason. Like, I'm from here. That's why I kind of want to set one up here. Because, you know, we don't have the industry. We're talking about these semiconductor factories, right? So we don't have that industry
here.
Yeah,
you can just say that. We're talking about opening small semiconductor factory together.
Yeah. And so we don't have that industry here. So the question, when people ask me, why in Kuwait? Why aren't you building one in the U.S. or somewhere else? I'm like, no, they're going to build it all over. But I'm from Kuwait. I want us to have one. We can. And so it's just that, Matthew. It's like, is opening people's eyes to the potential of what we can do. And that's what I think this factory can do for us.
Yeah, you know, and it's more than symbolically great, but it is symbolically great too. You know, yeah. I have a friend who's kind of a famous artist, and he wants to do this project in the UAE, and it, which is take a giant oil tanker and turn it up sideways so that it stands up, and it's like twice as big as the the Statue of Liberty or something. When you stack it up, which would be just this enormous, extremely expensive project as a sort of symbol about climate change, and that's super cool. But at the same time, if your symbol is also something that is functional in a way and actually transforms it, that's much more than a symbol. It's something real. It's productive. It's exciting. And, you know, and again, this isn't indeed any judgment on an oil rich nation. You've done a lot of really good and good for the world based on that. But, you know, what is the future and how can that continue on?
Yeah. I mean, and this is, you know, a test to us, right? Like, because Oil is like a gift. Kuwait wasn't a rich country before the 60s, right? So once we struck gold via oil, everything changed. And so, are we going to take that for granted? Are we going to get complacent? Are we going to just lose our way? Or are we going to use that to propel us into something really special? That's what I think we can do, is can we use the wealth that we get from oil to do something incredible? And that's the test, I think, because anyone can strike gold and just do live a wealthy life for a few generations. But how long can you maintain that? What can you do with that? How can you transform from that place of extreme wealth and privilege into a consistent high standard of living for your people? So yeah.
By the way, I think that high standard of living is really important to stress in Kuwait. I mean, Kuwait does take care of its people in a way that is a good example for the world, I think. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, we have free healthcare, free education, subsidies on a bunch of stuff. You're really well taken care of. You're not worried here. We don't have any homeless people. Anyone who needs a job and is a Kuwaiti citizen will get a job guaranteed by the government. You're super well protected, right? I mean, I think it's ideal as long as you can keep your people motivated.
And that's, doing new things can help with that, I guess.
Yeah.
Why go elsewhere if you have the most exciting technology in your backyard?
Exactly. You don't want to just be comfortable and then get excited about everywhere else in the world. You want your home to be exciting. And I think that's what you guys have in the US, right? And so we did too for a very long time. And I hope we can continue. Do we, was that clear, the QFAP stuff? Should we speak about it?
I don't want to self-promote too much on this,
Really? Okay.
we can if I lead into it for you to say something rather than me. what would be a good way to get into that without me looking like I'm self-promoting?
Well, because I'm going to be working with you, right? So.
Okay. No. Yeah. Let me just talk about that.
I think it's important because
I want to, and then at the same time, is this here for me to just be talking about stuff that I'm?
I kind of want to flip it and interview you. I think you should be interviewed on your own podcast.
Wolfram did that and I couldn't believe it.
Oh, really?
I was so nervous about that podcast because he's the smartest guy on the planet and I've admired him forever. And at the end, he goes, tell me what Nanotronix is doing. Tell me what you're doing. And
I heard that.
Oh my God. Stephen Wolfram's asking me questions.
Yeah, it should be because you're super interesting and you should be talking about this stuff.
No. Well, okay. I mean, you and I are working on a project together, which is sort of the culmination of everything that I've wanted to do in my life. And we get to do this together. Talk about it a little bit. I'd love to hear what you have to say.
Okay. Well, so, this all started when we started talking to each other in 2020. I was trying, you were helping me understand Nanotronix as a business, but also nanotechnology in general. And then we spoke about can we build a nano factory in the Middle East? Because if we do that in the Middle East, it's so far advanced in terms of what we already have in the region that it's going to definitely inspire everything, right? It's going to inspire the love of science and engineering all over again. It's going to inspire new industries, new courses, even in curriculums in both schools and universities and stuff. And so we can both tell the impact of setting up a factory like this here would be kind of unlimited, in my opinion, because it's just going to grow exponentially. And so, and we have the funding and we have the capabilities. As long as you get a government to support this, it should be easy. And so then you also were speaking about your dream. And I think you should be the one to talk about your dream of these little factories in our homes, right? Can you actually speak about that? And then I'll continue. Were telling me a bunch of stuff about your dream about nanofactories, but also about globalization.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, I was really inspired as a kid by two things. I guess as a kid, as a teenager, by Star Trek and this idea of having this replicator where you could order whatever you want and it would just appear. And I tried to figure out if there was science behind this, if it was actually a possibility. And, you know, then this guy, Eric Drexler, wrote a book called Engines of What am I saying? I'm missing the name.
Edges of Creation, yeah.
Oh my God.
And Radical Abundance, right? Both?
Yeah. Engines of Creation. And it was this map for how this world could actually work. And that was in 1986. And I mean, this was a long time ago. And yet, as I started to work in this field of nanotechnology, I realized that that artificial intelligence is converging with nanotechnology in a really interesting way that could make it possible. So while factories have been growing in size, you hear things like Tesla's gigafactories. They're actually huge. They're, you know, 2 kilometers wide or something like that. It's really incredible.
That's crazy.
I've been wanting to do the opposite. You know, the smaller you can make one, the closer to the size, the better the energy efficiency, and the more you can distribute them around the world. So we found a material, some technologies that would be the first step towards that. And while it's not something that is a replicator in your home yet, it's something that could be in your backyard. And this changes the way that business is thought of. It's, you know, getting chips on demand for anything that powers our lives. So, you know, starting this and doing some of these in your region, starting doing them and then doing them all around the world sort of changes the way that we view manufacturing and view having those things that we need where we need it.
Yeah, and it's so inspiring, Matthew, because you even spoke about like globalization, right? Rather than leveraging our natural resources or whatever we have, we start trading ideas instead and provide, you know, have everyone have the capability to manufacture whatever they want, but then we're exchanging ideas with each other, right? This is kind of how you explain.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the future in general is this, that, you know, our technologies are getting so good that we start to now focus on what it means to be human. You start asking your technologies to produce those things that are best for society. And you know, the ideas are not limited to your own. It's something that should be shared and something that's to be taken and to be leveraged in this different way. And so it's not about material resources anymore. It's about ideas.
Yeah, that's incredible. And you know, I can't wait to see not only the first CubeFabs built, but the 100th CubeFab. And I just want to see how they interact together. And CubeFabs are what we're calling these factories, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that you can build, I mean, I just want to talk a little bit about these factories because they're really exciting to me. And this isn't even what I got excited about when I met you and learned about nanotronics. This is what's amazing.
No, it's the fedora. It was the fedora and the jazz.
It was the fedora and the jazz, and your AI and your NSPEC device. And so this is a new idea. And so what's interesting to me is how much bigger can you go with your ideas, Matthew? And so having a semiconductor facility that's about 1,500 square meters anywhere in the world. That can you manufacture chips better than what we see today, and having that, you know, in regions like India and Egypt and places where it would really, really, really benefit the local environment and local talent. I mean, what you're doing is really changing the world. And so when I speak to people about this, if they don't jump up and down by the end of it, I know they didn't really get it. And so for me, I'm getting anxious, right? If you go back to like staying present in the future, it's always anticipation of that future that creates and causes this anxiety. And so I'm getting anxious and just because I just want to see the first one built, because I know each one's going to look like a beautiful landmark within the country. And then what's even more exciting is 10 years later, how different is each CubeFab from the other based on, right, the local environment and based on the local kind of partner that works on this and decides how it's going to evolve and what you're going to manufacture and what it's going to look like and what's the R&D and the AI going to spit out for us. And so I mean, this is really, really something you should be talking about day and night, to be honest.
No, I find it really, it is amazing. It's not that already ideas are being shared just in the discussions of the building of a QFab in different areas. You know, what one area you go to will say they're opening an electric vehicle company and they need to have, you know, power inverters for getting more mileage out of an electric vehicle. So, let's build a QFab for that. And it's, you know, how are we making these that it's similar enough that you can build anything with these anywhere? And, you know, I'm noticing this, different regions want different things. You know, I love that.
Yeah. And Matthew, it's what you're really doing is exactly what you wanted, I think, which is how Star Trek bred this love for science, right? In the people who, in its fans. I think what you're doing is the same because you're, I'm getting obsessed about this. Like I really, really am. And because I want to understand it, I start learning as much as I can about it. Then I speak to a potential partner in Saudi or in Kuwait or somewhere. And then they, because they start to realize, and it's infectious, right? The excitement is infectious. So they start realizing, oh, how big of an opportunity this might be, they start researching and understanding. And then a month later, 2 months later, they're speaking really well about it, that it's impressive. It's like, this is someone who had zero background in any of this. And now look at how they talk about it. And if you can do that, you know, before we even begin, before the first brick is laid down, then imagine what can happen when all of these start opening up and interacting and working together. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, I'm amazed by exactly what you're saying, that this is not an intimidating technology, the way that, even though I would say semiconductors are some of the most complicated field and most advanced field of anything in the world. You know, you have PhDs working on the factory floor. You know, it's pretty amazing. But I've noticed this, that after one conversation and sending some information, we meet with a partner again, a potential partner again, and they're pitching it for us. Yeah. You know, it's pretty cool because maybe they see how it'll affect their lives, or I love that.
It's super inspiring, and this is what I love, and this is what I hope I can do for the rest of my life, is surround myself with people like you that can inspire me, that can teach me, that can help me grow. Because, what really is life but this process? And what we're supposed to attain throughout this process, we don't know, or maybe we can just guess. But I think for me, it's trying to reach, the tip of Maslow's hierarchy, right? So self-actualization. Mm-hmm. So just how far can I go as a human being? And by far, I don't, it's not physical, right? It's always spiritual. And so in order for me to develop myself spiritually, I really do need to understand more about the world and my surroundings. I really do need to be able to experience more. I need to get out of my comfort zone. I need to face my fears. I need to do all of these things. And so interacting with these technologies and with, scientists and innovators like you gives me that. And so, I mean, thank you for that. But I'm curious to hear from you. What is it that makes you excited about everything you're building?
Oh my gosh. I mean, this is connecting the dots in ways that, most people would think are not possible. I mean, I'm excited for, I really think that society is on this sort of brink of either being an incredibly dystopian, difficult place or this incredibly utopian one. And there's nothing to do but to fight for that utopian one. Just like if I look at even the portfolio of companies you invest in, and then you look at Nanotronics or these CubeFabs, these things go together in a way that help build it. There's biotech companies that we're involved with. There's quantum computing companies that we're involved with. And when you look at those and you put those together, you have a society of abundance that is pretty amazing. You know, there's already this false scarcity in the world. There are things that are more abundant than we realize. But if there is something that is right next to you, and you're not looking at some complex trade route to get to you, if it's right there next to you, you realize that it is abundantly available. And we get to exactly where you are in trying to have society reach the next level in Maslow's hierarchy. I mean, I think that is everything.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And so but in aiming for utopia, and I love this about you, Matthew, and I love that you're able to continuously aim for utopia no matter what's going on around the world. Now, if we have abundance, and we know this, right? I think people know we have, for example, an abundance of food, but it's misallocated, right? So these technologies that you say give us all of this abundance, how can we make sure we don't face a similar issue of misallocation with them?
Well, if you had a vertical farm, a 3D printer, and some software that does AI and, a small semiconductor fab that just for your neighborhood and that produces some photovoltaics. It's like a few things that people need. I thought about this. Kuwait is an example of a country that provides a lot, as we said, for its citizens. The United States is not as good with this. We've talked about this thing in politics over the last few years, universal basic income. I don't know if you've heard about this.
Yeah, of course.
But, just giving people something that they can, a small amount of money they can allocate to whatever they like to do. And, while that's an interesting idea, I think what if you just allocated these things that I just mentioned, vertical farm, and for your house, a 3D printer, a couple things, and something for your neighborhood. That produces the electricity that you need. It also produces the chips you need for your phone. If you were able to do these kinds of things, then everything is so close that you're not worried about allocation. You're allocating to yourself, essentially.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So you just made another case for QFABs being basically the solution to the false scarcity that we see in the world. That's amazing.
I think that's
amazing that you were able to come up with a model and a project that is actually feasible today.
Well, what we have to do is do things extremely. I think part of the big thing about CubeFabs and atomically precise manufacturing, which is another word for nanotechnology, but if the thing about it is that you produce very little waste. So you're not looking for large quantities of material. You're looking for the amount of material you need for that thing only.
Right.
So there's not landfills of things, and you're not trying to, you don't need to have massive mines in order to have, a 5G antenna on your phone, for instance.
Yeah.
I think that's a big part of it as well.
So to me, it almost seems like I don't even know, and this might just be a bias of, what I'm exposed to and what I experience and know. But it seems to me now, after knowing this, that I don't even understand how life can move forward without it. It seems necessary for every single technology we talk about, any industry we talk about, whether it be, food security, whether it be cybersecurity, whether it be the semiconductor industry, VR and AR, right? Even blockchain and like just compute, just hardware and all that stuff. All of that, it seems necessary to have something like this in the world. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to advance much further than we are today. Is that true?
I think that's right. And I think that there's also something psychological about it that's really important. People tend to not really understand that technology and science are possible anymore. It's a distant thing from them. Even if they hold it in their hands, they don't quite have a sense of what it is because they don't know where it comes from.
Right.
Which is
what I was like pre-blockchain. That's exactly how I felt.
So you start to realize what is, and see and feel this technology and science as being something real, then your imagination is ignited and you start to try to dream of things. And then you start to build things. And then this power of the billions of people on the planet are realized in a way that they just aren't when things are at a distance the way they are right now.
It's amazing how understanding technology inherently creates optimism, right? Maybe that's what it is. Maybe that's how you've been able to target utopia forever. Like it's just, you see what's possible, and you're experiencing the solutions to all the problems, right? It's just about kind of getting them out there, or maybe scaling them, or maybe giving them support.
Yeah, and people don't think, people hear the word technology, they don't even think of the stuff we're talking about. They think it often is something that is tied to advertising. Our best technology is wasted on good marketing.
Yeah.
I,
Do you think that's changing though now? Do you think people, because a lot of these like large funds are now looking at deep tech as well.
What do you think?
It seems to be a shift.
You know more than I do about that.
I mean, if we're talking about 2020, no, not at all. Because I remember speaking, you know, remember Matthew, when we were on Clubhouse and we were speaking about nanotechnology and everyone was saying nanotechnology isn't real, it's for charlatans and all that crazy
stuff.
Yes,
I remember.
And so I guess now, no, I guess now people are a bit more humble about deep tech and saying at least they don't resist it, maybe. And you see some of these, you know, big investors switching into deep tech. Now, what deep tech can mean for different people maybe is different. I don't know. But in general, you do see I don't know. You would know better than me, though. An increased interest in AI, in robotics, in VR and AR and those technologies. I don't know what you're seeing, but I think that's happening.
Yeah, and certainly in space tech, you know.
Space tech, for sure. Yeah, space tech is hot right now.
Yeah. No, I see the attitudes changing some. I definitely do. I think that a big part of this too is to get to the point where we don't need as much massive investment in deep tech to make deep tech happen. And I think that's with CubeFabs. We're saying it's not actually that expensive.
Yeah.
People are even skeptical of that, right?
Yeah,
you see the price, oh, that's not possible. Because they've heard.
You know, and to some, it was too cheap. It was too cheap to some. I was like, okay, well, you can spend more and make it bigger.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, some deep tech investments that I looked at 2 years ago that I was, you know, $200 million Series A.
That's crazy.
So if you say if you come out with something that is much, much less expensive, I think people don't realize you're actually doing, you know, something as ambitious as a deep tech factory, right? This is a big deal.
It's a huge deal. I'm glad. And you know, Matthew, I can't believe how you must feel, you know, talking about this for as many years as you have been. Me doing it for a year and a half, I'm getting frustrated a little bit, but not too frustrated. I'm still excited. But it's frustrating because you want people, I always want people to get as excited as I am, and maybe that's a flaw in me, but when they don't, I'm like, either I didn't deliver the message right, or they didn't get it, or there's no way they're not excited about this. And so I don't know how you did it all these years, but do you see a difference in sentiment when you start speaking about the same things you've been speaking about for so many years?
Do I notice a difference now?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do. I do. Okay. And I think a big thing is that for us, this message is a lot clearer. You know, it's clear if you say, yes, I will do all the building, I'll take care of it and hand you the final product. You know, rather than, you know, for me, it was always, I'll give you a tool so that you can build it.
Right.
And I thought that was a good idea because I thought, you know, people are full of ideas. They're the ones that can build it as long as I give them a tool to do so. But, you know, if you don't inherently believe that technology is possible or that science is possible, then you need to go the whole way. And so I don't find that this is hard of a story to tell.
In
many ways, you know, but, you know, we will see. But I, you know, I want to build the 100th like you do, you know, and we'll get to a point where, you know, you build a couple of these and people see that it's possible and then it should be everywhere.
And when it's everywhere, though, Matthew, when it's everywhere, there's some people who told me, Anwar, but then, you know, it'll kind of exacerbate this us versus them mentality because everyone will become local. You're just localizing everything to the point where trade and global commerce, you're kind of limiting it. Now, I think the opposite would be happening. But what do you think? What do you say to people who think?
I mean, I'd like to eliminate, you know, the wars, whether it's trade wars or whether it's actually hot wars on the ground or cold wars, you know, the struggle that we see is, I don't think it's because of globalization per se. I think globalization was a good way to communicate and be able to be interconnected. But I think that when you see any vulnerabilities in that, such as supply chain vulnerabilities, or you see, you know, geopolitical differences, then you become really vulnerable to these things like war. And I see this being, you know, an antidote for that. There's ways that trade will still exist. You know, I talked about how you know, some areas may want power inverters for EVs, and, you know, and others may want communication satellites, right? These are two things that, that different places might want. Those can still be traded,
right?
You know, between cube fabs.
Right.
And then when one wants something else, you can shoot that demand to the other cube fab and they can build it.
What if though, as a country, I know that I so if I have the tools, if I have the facility and the tools to basically manufacture anything I want, and if I have the facility and tools to manufacture whatever the other person is manufacturing, why would I trade with them? Why can't I just expand my facility and just basically be completely self-sustainable?
Well, you could, and that would be okay too. You know, and, you know, then there's no reason for any conflict with the others if you're already producing it.
Right.
You know, it's, you know, we live in an era where we have communication globally. That's what's important then. You know, if you can build locally and have communication globally, that's pretty exciting.
Yeah. Well, and also your AI gets trained in all of this, right?
Yeah.
And it gets trained on a variety of different processes and a variety of different products and stuff. And so we can't even imagine what that would show us, right? What that would do for us.
Yeah. I mean, imagine that this is what super intelligent AI is. You know, that with the concerns about super intelligent AI are always looking at it in the world that we currently have. And you could see how, you know, it would be, things could be dangerous in a world of conflict, even if it's just, you know, internal conflict or global conflict. But if your AI is being used to build something that is abundant in order for it to help your society, and it's learning and growing and getting super intelligent and, you know, is better than anything we can imagine, I mean, that's only positive.
Right. Right. Yeah. I'm really excited, Matthew, for
I can't believe we're doing this together. I'm so excited too.
Yeah, I'm so excited. I mean, I would be silly and ridiculous not to jump at this. It's truly one of the most exciting things I've ever had the pleasure of experiencing. I can't wait for it to happen. And I think, you know, if you're able, Matthew, to prove abundance on a physical level, if you're able to prove and support the first two tiers of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, then we can together kind of all of us work on building a new system where everyone is incentivized to climb up that pyramid, right? Where everyone has the energy and time and ability and freedom to focus on that, because who knows how many, you know, we have one life or so it seems. And so if that is the case, you don't want to be wasting it kind of trying to scrape for the bottom, you know, for the necessities, right? So if I can just be supported the way my country supported me, right? If the whole world can have that, then all of us are kind of competing to the top of that pyramid. That's a better and healthier way to compete, because at the end of it, what you're trying to target and what you're trying to reach is basically the purest form of love and the purest form of yourself. And so
I want to say, you know, we can do this. That's not, you know, there's plenty right now to be scared of, and we can stop that. I mean, even pandemics, right? We can make a type of lighting that will kill pathogens in the air.
Yeah.
You know, let's hold each other's hands through this, and build something that will bring us to that next level of Maslow's hierarchy.
Yeah. Oh, I can't wait to do that.
Yeah.
Thank you for letting me join.
Was this fun to talk about? Was this more fun?
Yeah, I think it was important because you haven't spoken about it. You have to speak about it.
Yeah.
And your intentions and the, you know, and your motivations and everything that you spoke about, like all of that.
Well, I like this sort of, there's certainly a sense in what we talked about where it's, God, people are crazy. Hurry up and rush to this. You want to do this now.
Yeah. There is that sense of urgency for sure. So I'm glad we did it.
Yeah. You know, Anwar, I would say I could talk to you forever, but I do. I continue. Our conversation never ends. And I wish I could let people in for longer, but I really appreciate you doing this with me.
Oh, of course, Matthew. It's such a pleasure and an honor. You know, you're my mentor in life, so this is truly a privilege for me.
Mutual. Thank you, Anwar.
Of course. Thank you, Matthew.